before 9 p.m. when Sara phoned.
"How's the jet lag?" she asked.
"My sleep cycle's messed up, but otherwise I feel fine," Tsukuru said.
"Can you talk now, or are you sleepy?"
"I'm sleepy, but I can hold out another hour before I go to bed. I have to go to work tomorrow and can't very well take a nap at the office."
"That's good," Sara said.
"Someone called my home around 1 this afternoon. That was you, right? I keep forgetting to check my messages and just noticed I missed a call."
"That was me.
I was out shopping in the neighborhood."
"Hmm," Tsukuru said.
"But you didn't leave a message."
"I'm not very good at leaving phone messages. I get kind of nervous and don't know what to say."
"You could have at least said your name."
"You're right. I should have at least done that."
She paused for a moment.
"I was quite worried about you, you know. Whether your trip went well. You should have left a short message."
"I'm sorry. I know I should have." Tsukuru apologized. "By the way, what did you do today?"
"I did the laundry and went shopping. Cooked, cleaned the kitchen and the bathroom. Sometimes I need that kind of quiet day off."
She fell silent for a while.
"So, were you able to take care of everything in Finland?"
"I got to see Kuro," Tsukuru said. "The two of us had a good long talk. Olga really helped me out."
"I'm glad. She's a nice girl, isn't she?"
"She really is." He told her about driving an hour and a half out of Helsinki to a beautiful lakeside town to see Eri, or Kuro. How she lived in a summer cottage there with her husband, her two young daughters, and a dog. How she and her husband made pottery in a small studio nearby.
"She looked happy," Tsukuru said. "Life in Finland seems to agree with her.
Except for some nights during the long dark winter. But he didn't say this.
"Was it worth going all the way to Finland?" Sara asked.
"I think so. There are some things you can only talk about face to face. It cleared up a lot of things for me. Not that I've found all the answers, but it was definitely worthwhile. On an emotional level, I mean."
"That's wonderful. I'm very happy to hear it."
A short silence followed. A suggestive silence, as if it were measuring the direction of the wind. Then Sara spoke.
"Your voice sounds different. Or am I just imagining things?"
"I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm tired. I've never been on a plane for that long before."
"But there were no problems?"
"No, no real problems. There's so much I need to tell you, but once I start, I know it's going to take a long time. I'd like to see you soon and tell you the whole story, from start to finish."
"That sounds good. Let's get together. Anyway, I'm glad your trip to Finland wasn't a waste of time."
"Thank you for all your help. I really appreciate it."
"You're quite welcome."
Another short silence followed. Tsukuru listened carefully. The sense of something unspoken still hung in the air.
"There's something I'd like to ask you," Tsukuru said, deciding to take the plunge. "Maybe it would be better not to, but I think I should go with what I'm feeling."
"Certainly, go ahead," Sara said. "It's best to go with your feelings. Ask me anything."
"I can't find the right words exactly. But I get the sense that you're seeing someone else besides me. It's been bothering me for a while."
Sara didn't respond right away.
"You get that sense?" she finally asked. "Are you saying that for whatever reason you get that sort of feeling?"
"That's right. For whatever reason I do," Tsukuru said. "But like I've said before, I'm not the most intuitive person in the world. My brain's basically set up to make things, tangible things, like my name implies.
My mind has a very straightforward structure. The complex workings of other people's minds are beyond me. Or even my own mind. I'm often totally wrong when it comes to subtle things like this. So I try to avoid thinking about anything too complex. But this has been weighing on me for a while. And I thought I should ask you, instead of pointlessly brooding over it.
I see, Sara said.
So, is there someone else?
She was silent.
Please understand, Tsukuru said. If there is someone else, I'm not criticizing you. I should probably mind my own business. You have no obligation to me, and I have no right to demand anything of you. I simply want to know whether what I'm feeling is wrong or not.
Sara sighed.
I'd prefer you didn't use words like obligation and rights. Makes it sound like you're debating the revision of the Constitution or something.
Okay, Tsukuru said.
I didn't put it well. Like I said, I'm a very simple person, and I don't think I can handle things while I feel this way.
Sara was silent for a moment. He could clearly picture her, phone in hand, lips pursed tight. Her voice was soft when she finally spoke.
You're not a simple person. You just try to think you are. Maybe, if you say so. I don't really know. But a simple life suits me best. I do know that. The thing is, I've been hurt in my relationships with others. Hurt deeply. And I never want to go through that again.
I know, Sara said. You've been honest with me, so I'd like to be honest with you. But can I have a little time before I respond?
How much time?
How about 3 days? Today's Sunday, so I think I can talk on Wednesday. I can answer your question then. Are you free Wednesday night?
Wednesday night's open, Tsukuru said.
He didn't have to check his schedule. Once night fell, he seldom had plans.
Let's have dinner together. We can discuss things then, honestly. Does that sound good?
Sounds good, Tsukuru said. They hung up. That night, Tsukuru had a long, bizarre dream. He was seated at a piano, playing a sonata, a huge brand new grand piano. The white keys utterly white, the black keys utterly black. An oversized score lay open on the music stand. Beside him stood a woman, dressed in a tight, subdued black dress, swiftly turning the pages for him with her long, pale fingers. Her timing was impeccable. Her jet-black hair hung to her waist. Everything in the scene appeared in gradations of white and black. There were no other colors. He had no idea who had composed the sonata. It was a lengthy piece, though, with a score as thick as a phone book. The pages were filled with notes, literally covered in black. It was a challenging composition, with a complex structure, and required a superior technique. And he had never seen it before. Still, he was able to sight-read it, instantly grasping the world expressed there, and transforming this vision into sound. Just like being able to visualize a complicated blueprint in 3D, he had this special ability. His 10 practiced fingers raced over the keyboard like a whirlwind. It was a dazzling, invigorating experience, accurately decoding this enormous sea of ciphers more quickly than anyone else, and instantaneously giving them form and substance. Absorbed in his playing, his body was pierced by a flash of inspiration, like a bolt of lightning on a summer afternoon. The music had an ambitious virtuoso structure, but at the same time it was beautifully introspective. It honestly and delicately expressed, in a full tangible way, what it meant to be alive. A crucial aspect of the world that could only be expressed through the medium of music. His spine tingled with the sheer joy and pride of performing this music himself. Sadly, though, the people seated before him seemed to feel otherwise. They fidgeted in their seats, bored and irritated. He could hear the scraping of chairs and people coughing. For some reason, they were oblivious to the music's value. He was performing in the grand hall of a royal court. The floor was smooth marble, the ceiling vaulted, with a lovely skylight in the middle. The members of the audience, there must have been about 50 people, were seated on elegant chairs as they listened to the music. Well-dressed, refined, no doubt cultured individuals, but unfortunately, they were unable to appreciate this marvelous music. As time passed, the clamor they made grew louder, even more grating. There was no stopping it now, as it overwhelmed the music. By now, even he could no longer hear the music he was playing. What he heard instead was a grotesquely amplified and exaggerated noise, the sounds of coughs and groans of discontent. Still, his eyes remained glued to the score, his fingers racing over the keyboard as if he were possessed. He had a sudden realization. The woman in black, turning the pages of the score for him, had six fingers. The sixth finger was about the same size as her little finger. He gasped and felt a shudder run through his chest. He wanted to look up at the woman standing beside him. Who was she? Did he know her? But until that movement of the score was over, he couldn't spare a moment's glance away. Even if there wasn't a single person now who was still listening. At this point, Tsukuru awoke. The green numbers on his bedside clock read 2:35. His body was covered in sweat, his heart still beating out the dry cadence of time passing. He got up, tugged off his pajamas, wiped himself down with a towel, put on a new t-shirt and boxers, and sat down on the sofa in the living room. In the darkness, he thought about Sara. He agonized over every word he'd spoken to her earlier on the phone. He should never have said what he did. He wanted to call her and take back everything that he'd said. But he couldn't call anyone at nearly 3 a.m., and asking her to forget what he'd already said was all the more impossible. At this rate, I might well lose her, he thought. His thoughts turned to Eri. Eri Kurono Haatainen, the mother of two small girls. He pictured the blue lake beyond the stand of white birch trees, and the little boat slapping against the pier. The pottery with its lovely designs, the chirps of the birds, the dog barking, and Alfred Brendel's meticulous rendition of Years of Pilgrimage. The feel of Eri's breasts pressed against him. Her warm breath, her cheeks wet with tears. All the lost possibilities, all the time that was never to return. At one point, seated across from each other at the table, they were silent, not even searching for words, their ears drawn to the sounds of the birds outside the window. The cries of the birds made for an unusual melody. The same melody pierced the woods over and over. "The parent birds are teaching the babies how to chirp," Eri said, and she smiled. "Until I came here, I never knew that birds have to be taught how to chirp."
"Our lives are like a complex musical score," Tsukuru thought, "filled with all sorts of cryptic writing, 16th and 32nd notes and other strange signs. It's next to impossible to correctly interpret these, and even if you could, and then could transpose them into the correct sounds, there's no guarantee that people would correctly understand or appreciate the meaning therein. No guarantee it would make people happy. Why must the workings of people's lives be so convoluted?" "Make sure you hang on to Sara," Eri had told him. "You really need her. You don't lack anything. Be confident and be bold. That's all you need. And don't let the bad elves get you." He thought of Sara, imagined her lying naked in someone else's arms. No, not someone. He'd actually seen the man. Sara had looked so very happy then, her beautiful white teeth showing in a broad smile. He closed his eyes in the darkness
and pressed his fingertips against his temples. He couldn't go on feeling this way, he decided, even if it was only for 3 more days. Tsukuru picked up the phone and dialed Sara's number. It was just before 4. The phone rang a dozen times before Sara picked up.
"I'm really sorry to call you at this hour," Tsukuru said, "but I had to talk to you."
"This hour? What time is it?"
"Almost 4 a.m.
"Goodness, I'd forgotten such a time actually existed," Sara said. Her voice sounded still half awake. "So who died?"
"Nobody died," Tsukuru said. "Nobody has died yet. But I just have something I need to tell you tonight."
"What sort of thing?"
"I love you, Sara. And I want you more than anything."
Over the phone, he heard a rustling sound, as if she were fumbling for something. She gave a small cough, then made a sound he took to be an exhalation.
"Is it okay to talk with you about it now?" Tsukuru asked.
"Of course," Sara said. "I mean, it's not even 4 yet. You can say whatever you want. Nobody's listening in. They're all sound asleep."
"I truly love you, and I want you," Tsukuru repeated.
"That's what you wanted to call me at not quite 4 a.m. to tell me?"
"That's right."
"Have you been drinking?"
"No, not a drop."
"I see," Sara said. "For a science type, you certainly can get pretty passionate."
"It's the same as building a station."
"How so?"
"It's simple. If there's no station, no trains will stop there. The first thing I have to do is picture a station in my mind and give it actual color and substance. That comes first. Even if I find a defect, that can be corrected later on. And I'm used to that kind of work."
"Because you're an outstanding engineer."
"I'd like to be."
"And you're building a specially made station just for me until nearly dawn."
"That's right," Tsukuru said. "Because I love you, and I want you."
"I'm fond of you, too, very much. I'm more attracted to you each time we meet," Sara said.
Then she paused, as if leaving a space on the page.
"But it's nearly 4 a.m. now. Even the birds aren't up yet. It's too early to think straight, so can you wait 3 more days?
"All right."
"But only 3, Tsukuru said. "I think that's my limit. That's why I called you at this hour."
3 days is plenty, Tsukuru. I'll keep to the construction completion date. Don't worry. I'll see you on Wednesday evening."
"I'm sorry to have woken you."
"It's all right. I'm glad to know that time still keeps on flowing at 4 in the morning. Is it light out yet?"
"Not yet. But it will be in a little while. The birds will start chirping."
"The early bird catches the worm."
"In theory.
But I don't think I'll be able to stay up to see that."
"Good night," he said.
"Tsukuru,"
Sara said.
"Hmm?"
"Good night," Sara said.
"Relax and get some rest."
And with that, she hung up. Chapter 19. Shinjuku Station is enormous. Every day nearly 3.5 million people pass through it. So many that the Guinness Book of World Records officially lists JR Shinjuku Station as the station with the most passengers in the world. A number of railroad lines cross there, the main ones being the Chuo Line, Sobu Line, Yamanote Line, Saikyo Line, Shonan Shinjuku Line, and the Narita Express. The rails intersect and combine in complex and convoluted ways. There are 16 platforms in total. In addition, there are 2 private rail lines, the Odaki Line and the Keio Line, and 3 subway lines plugged in, as it were, from the side. It is a total maze. During rush hour, that maze transforms into a sea of humanity, a sea that foams up, rages, and roars as it surges toward the entrances and exits. Streams of people changing trains become entangled, giving rise to dangerous, swirling whirlpools. No prophet, no matter how righteous, could part that fierce, turbulent sea. It's hard to believe that every morning and evening, 5 days a week, this overwhelming crush of human beings is dealt with efficiently, without any major problems, by a staff of station employees that no one would ever accuse of being adequate, in terms of numbers, to the task. The morning rush hour is particularly problematic. Everyone is scurrying to get to where they need to be, to punch their time clock, and no one's in a great mood. They're still tired, half asleep, and riding the bursting-at-the-seams trains is physically and emotionally draining. Only the very lucky managed to find a seat. Tsukuru was always amazed that riots don't break out, that there are no tragic, bloody disasters. If a fanatical band of terrorists did happen to target one of these jam-packed stations or trains, it would be lethal, with a horrific loss of life. For the people working on the rail lines, and the police, and of course the passengers, this remained the one unimaginable nightmare scenario. And there was no way to prevent it, even now after such a nightmare actually did take place in Tokyo in the spring of 1995. Station employees bark out endless announcements over the loudspeakers. A repetitious tune marking train departures plays constantly. The automated wickets silently input a huge amount of information from all the rail cards, tickets, and train passes they scan. The long trains, their arrivals and departures timed down to the second, are like long-suffering, well-trained farm animals, systematically exhaling and inhaling people, impatiently closing their doors as they rush off toward the next station. The crowds surge up and down the stairs. But if someone steps on your foot from behind and your shoe comes off, good luck ever retrieving it. The shoe is sucked into the intense rush hour quicksand, where it vanishes forever. The person who suffers this fate has a long day ahead, clomping around on one shoe. In the early 1990s, before Japan's bubble economy burst, a leading newspaper in the U.S. published a large photo taken on a winter's morning of rush hour commuters in Shinjuku Station, or possibly Tokyo Station. The same applies to both, heading down the stairs. As if by agreement, all the commuters were gazing downward, their expressions strained and unhappy, looking more like lifeless fish packed in a can than people. The article said, "Japan may be affluent, but most Japanese look like this, heads downcast and unhappy-looking." The photo became famous. Tsukuru had no idea if most Japanese were, as the article claimed, unhappy. But the real reason that most passengers descending the stairs at Shinjuku Station during their packed morning commute were looking down was less that they were unhappy than that they were concerned about their footing. Don't slip on the stairs. Don't lose a shoe. These are the major issues on the minds of the commuters in the Mammoth Station during rush hour. There was no explanation of this, no context for the photograph. Certainly, it was hard to view this mass of people, clad in dark overcoats, their heads down, as happy. And of course, it's logical to see a country where people can't commute in the morning without fear of losing their shoes as an unhappy society. Tsukuru wondered how much time people spend simply commuting to work every day. Say the average commute was between an hour and a half. That sounded about right. If your typical office worker, working in Tokyo, married with a child or two, wanted to own his own house, the only choice was to live in the suburbs and spend that much time getting to work and back. So 2 to 3 hours out of every 24 would be spent simply in the act of commuting. If you were lucky, you might be able to read the newspaper or a paperback in the train. Maybe you could listen to your iPod, to a Haydn symphony, or a conversational Spanish lesson. Some people might even close their eyes, lost in deep metaphysical speculation. Still, it would be hard to call these 2 or 3 hours rewarding, quality time. How much of one's life was snatched away, to simply vanish as a result of this most likely pointless movement from point A to point B. And how much did this effort exhaust people and wear them down? But these were not issues that Tsukuru Tazaki, a railroad company employee tasked with designing stations, needed to worry about. It wasn't his life. Let people live their own lives. Each person should decide for himself how happy or unhappy our society might be. All Tsukuru had to think about was what might be the safest and most efficient way to keep this massive flow of people moving. For a job like this, reflection is not required, as it simply calls for accurate, tested, best practices. He was no thinker or sociologist, but a mere engineer. Tsukuru Tazaki loved to watch JR Shinjuku Station. When he went to the station, he would buy a platform ticket from the machine and go upstairs to the platform between tracks 9 and 10. This is where express trains on the Chuo line came and went, long-distance trains to places like Matsumoto and Kofu. Compared to the platform for commuters, there were far fewer passengers, fewer trains arriving and departing. He could sit on a bench and leisurely observe what went on in the station. Tsukuru visited railroad stations like other people enjoy attending concerts, watching movies, dancing in clubs, watching sports, and window shopping. When he was at loose ends, with nothing to do, he headed to a station. When he felt anxious or needed to think, his feet carried him once again of their own accord to a station. He'd sit quietly on a bench on the platform, sip coffee he bought at a kiosk, and check the arrival and departure times against the pocket-sized timetable he always carried in his briefcase. He could spend hours doing this. Back when he was a college student, he used to examine the station's layout, the passenger flow, the movements of the station staff, writing detailed observations in his notebook, but he was beyond that now. An express train slows down as it pulls up to the platform. The doors open and passengers alight, one after another. Just watching this made him feel calm and content. When trains arrived and departed right on schedule, he felt proud, even if the station wasn't one his company had helped to construct. A quiet, simple sense of pride. A cleaning team quickly boards the train, collecting trash and turning the swivel seats around so they all neatly face forward. A new crew, wearing hats and uniforms, boards and briskly runs through a checklist. The destination sign is replaced, along with the train's designated number. Everything proceeds smoothly, efficiently, without a hitch, down to the second. This is Tsukuru Tazaki's world. At Helsinki Central Station, he had done the same thing. He got a simple train schedule, sat down on a bench, and, sipping hot coffee from a paper cup, watched the long-distance trains arrive and depart. He checked their destinations on a map and where they'd come from. He observed the passengers getting off the trains, watched others rushing toward their respective platforms to board more trains, and followed the movements of the uniformed station employees and train crews. As always, doing this calmed him. Time passed smoothly, homogeneously. Other than not being able to understand the PA announcements, it was no different from being in Shinjuku Station. The protocol for operating a railway station was pretty much the same throughout the world, the whole operation reliant on precise, skillful professionalism. This aroused a natural response in him, a sure sense that he was in the right place. On Tuesday, when Tsukuru finished work, it was after 8. At this time of night, he was the only one left in his office. The work he had left to do wasn't so urgent that he needed to stay late to finish it, but he was meeting Sara on Wednesday evening, and he wanted to complete any leftover tasks before then. He decided to call it a day, switched off his computer, locked up important disks and documents in a drawer, and turned off the light. He left through the company's rear entrance, saying goodnight to the security guard he knew by sight.
"Have a good night, sir," the guard said to him.
He thought of having dinner somewhere, but wasn't hungry. Still, he didn't feel like going straight home, so he headed for JR Shinjuku Station. This evening, too, he bought coffee at a kiosk. It was a typical muggy Tokyo summer night, and his back was sweaty. But still he preferred hot black coffee, the steam rising off it, to a cold drink. It was just a habit. As always, on Platform 9, the final night train bound for Matsumoto was preparing for departure. The crew walked the length of the train, checking with practiced, diligent eyes that everything was in order. The train was not as sleek as a Shinkansen bullet train, but Tsukuru liked the plain, no-nonsense trains, these familiar E-257 models. The train would proceed to Shiojiri along the Chuo line, then run on the Shinonoi line to Matsumoto, and arrive in Matsumoto at 5 minutes till midnight. Until Hachioji, it was still in an urban area and had to keep the noise down. But after that, it ran through the mountains, where there were many curves, so it never could get up to the maximum speed. For the distance involved, the trip took a long time. There was still some time before the train opened its doors for boarding, yet passengers were hurriedly buying boxed dinners, snacks, cans of beer, and magazines at the kiosk. Some had white iPod headphones in their ears, already off in their own little worlds. Others palmed smartphones, thumbing out texts, some talking so loudly into their phones that their voices rose above the blaring PA announcements. Tsukuru spotted a young couple, seated close together on a bench, happily sharing secrets. A pair of sleepy-looking 5 or 6-year-old twin boys, with their mother and father dragging them along by their hands, were whisked past where Tsukuru sat. The boys clutched small game devices. Two young foreign men hefted heavy-looking backpacks, while a young woman was lugging a cello case. A woman with a stunning profile passed by. Everyone was boarding a night train, heading to a far-off destination. Tsukuru envied them. At least they had a place they needed to go. Tsukuru Tazaki had no place he needed to go. He realized that he had never actually been to Matsumoto or Kofu or Shiojiri, not even to the much closer town of Hachioji. He had watched countless express trains for Matsumoto depart from this platform, but it had never occurred to him that there was a possibility he could board one. Until now, he had never thought of it. Why is that, he wondered. Tsukuru imagined himself boarding this train and heading for Matsumoto. It wasn't exactly impossible, and it didn't seem like such a terrible idea. He'd suddenly gotten it into his head. After all, to take off for Finland. So why not Matsumoto? What sort of town was it, he wondered. What kind of lives did people lead there? But he shook his head and erased these thoughts. Tomorrow morning it would be impossible to get back to Tokyo in time for work. He knew that much without consulting the timetable. And he was meeting Sara tomorrow night. It was a very important day for him. He couldn't just take off for Matsumoto on a whim. He drank the rest of his now lukewarm coffee and tossed the paper cup into a nearby garbage bin. Tsukuru Tazaki had nowhere he had to go. This was like a running theme of his life. He had no place he had to go, no place to come back to. He never did, and he didn't now. The only place for him was where he was now. No, he thought, that's not entirely true. At one point in his life, he did have a place he needed to go to. In high school, he had his heart set on going to an engineering college in Tokyo and majoring in railroad station design. That was the place he needed to go. And he studied hard to make sure he could do so. His academic advisor had coolly warned him that with his grades, he had only a 20% chance of getting into that school. But he had done his best and somehow surmounted that hurdle. He had never studied so hard in his life. He wasn't cut out for competing with others for rank and grades, but given a set goal, he put his heart and soul into it. He exerted himself beyond anything he had ever imagined, and the experience was a new and precious discovery for him of his own capabilities. As a result, Tsukuru left Nagoya and ended up living alone in Tokyo. In Tokyo, he longed to return to his hometown as soon as he could, even if only for a short time, to see his friends again. At that point, Nagoya was the place he needed to go back to. He shuttled back and forth between two different places for a little over a year. But then, without warning, the cycle was broken. After this, he no longer had a place to go, or a place to which he could return. His house was still in Nagoya, his mother and eldest sister still living there, his room the same as he'd left it. His other older sister was also living in the city. Once or twice a year, he made an obligatory visit and was always warmly received, but there was nothing he needed to talk to his mother or sister about, and being with them never brought back any nostalgic feelings. What they sought from him was the Tsukuru of old, a person he had left behind and no longer needed. To revive that person and present him to his family necessitated that he play a role that made him uncomfortable. The streets of Nagoya now felt remote and dreary. There was nothing there he wanted, nothing that called up even a hint of warmth. Tokyo, meanwhile, was just the place he happened to end up. It was where he had attended school, where his job was located. Professionally, it was the place he belonged, but beyond that, the city meant nothing to him. In Tokyo, he lived a well-ordered, quiet life. Like a refugee in a foreign land, not making waves, not causing any trouble, being ever cautious so that his residence permit was not revoked. He lived there as if he were a refugee from his own life. And Tokyo was the ideal place for someone seeking a life of anonymity. He had no one he could call a close friend. A few girlfriends entered his life along the way, but they hadn't stayed together. Peaceful relationships followed by amicable breakups. Not a single person had really climbed inside his heart. He had not been seeking that sort of relationship, and most likely the women he went out with hadn't desired him that much either. So they were even. "It's like my life came to a halt at age 20," Tsukuru Tazaki thought, as he sat on the bench in Shinjuku Station. The days that came afterward had no real weight or substance. The years passed by, quietly, like a gentle breeze, leaving no scars behind, no sorrow, rousing no strong emotions, leaving no happiness or memories worth mentioning. And now he was entering middle age. No, he still had a few years to go before that. But it was true that he was no longer young. In a sense, Eri was a refugee from life as well. She too carried emotional scars, scars that had led her to leave everything behind and abandon her country. She had chosen a new world, Finland, on her own. And now she had a husband and two daughters, as well as her work making pottery, work in which she completely immersed herself. She had a summer cottage by the lake and a small chipper dog. She had learned Finnish and was steadily constructing her own little universe. "That makes her different from me," Tsukuru thought. He glanced at the Heuer watch on his left wrist. It was 8:50. Passengers had begun boarding the express train. One after another, people dragged their luggage aboard, plunking themselves down in their designated seats, stowing their bags in the overhead racks, settling down in the air-conditioned cars, sipping cold drinks. He could see them through the windows of the train. He'd inherited the watch from his father, one of the few tangible things he'd received. It was a beautiful antique from the early 1960s. If you didn't wear it for 3 days, the mechanism would wind down and the hands would stop. An inconvenience, but that's what Tsukuru liked about it. It was a purely mechanical device, a piece of craftsmanship. No quartz or a single microchip inside. Everything operated by delicate springs and gears. It had been working faithfully, without a rest, for a half century, and was even now surprisingly accurate. Tsukuru had never bought a watch himself, not once in his whole life. When he was young, someone inevitably gave him a cheap one, which he used without much thought. As long as it kept the right time, he didn't care what he wore. That was the extent of his feelings for watches. A simple Casio digital watch did the trick. So when his father died, and he was given this expensive wristwatch as a keepsake, again, it aroused no special feelings one way or the other. He had to make sure to wear it regularly so it didn't wind down. But once he got used to this, he found he had a great fondness for the watch. He enjoyed the weight and heft of it, the faint mechanical whir it made. He found himself checking the time more often than before, and each time he did, his father's shadow passed faintly through his mind. Truth be told, he didn't remember his father all that well, nor did he have particularly warm memories of him. He could not recall ever going anywhere with his father, from the time he was small until he was grown up, or even having a friendly talk, just the two of them. His father was basically an uncommunicative person, at least at home. He barely spoke. And besides, work kept him so busy that he was rarely around. Only now did Tsukuru realize that his father might have been keeping a mistress somewhere. To Tsukuru, he felt less like his real father than like some well-placed relative who often visited. Tsukuru was essentially raised by his mother and his two older sisters. He knew next to nothing about what sort of life his father had led, his thoughts and values, and what he actually did day to day. What he did know was that his father had been born in Gifu, had lost both parents while still a boy, was taken in by a paternal uncle who was a Buddhist priest, managed to graduate from high school, started a company from scratch, had tremendous success, and ultimately built up a substantial fortune. Unlike most people who had struggled in life, he preferred not to dwell on the trials he'd gone through, perhaps not wishing to relive the hard times. At any rate, it was clear that his father had an extraordinary head for business, the talent to immediately obtain what he needed, and jettison everything he didn't. Tsukuru's older sister had, in part, inherited this talent for business from her father, while the younger sister had also, in part, inherited her mother's cheerful sociability. Neither of these qualities had been passed on to Tsukuru. His father had smoked over 50 cigarettes a day and had died of lung cancer. When Tsukuru went to visit him at the hospital in Nagoya, he could no longer speak. His father seemed to want to tell him something, but couldn't do so. A month later, he died in his hospital bed. His father left him the one-bedroom condo in Jiugaoka, a bank account with a fair amount of money in his name, and his Heuer self-winding wristwatch. No, there was one other thing his father had left him. His name, Tsukuru Tazaki. When Tsukuru announced that he wanted to study at an engineering college in Tokyo, his father seemed deeply disappointed that his only son had no interest in taking over the real estate business he had worked so hard to build. Still, he fully supported Tsukuru's desire to become an engineer.
"If that's what you want," his father had told him, "then you should go to the college in Tokyo, and I'll be happy to pay for it. Learning a technical skill and building real objects is a good thing. It contributes to society.
Study hard, he had said.
And build as many stations as you like.
His father seemed pleased that the name he had chosen, Tsukuru, had turned out to be so appropriate. This was probably the first and last time Tsukuru had made his father happy, certainly the only time he had seen his father so openly pleased. At exactly 9 p.m., right on schedule, the express train for Matsumoto pulled away from the platform. Seated on a bench, Tsukuru watched as its lights faded down the tracks, as the train sped up and finally disappeared into the summer night. Once the last car was no longer visible, everything around him felt suddenly deserted. Even the lights of the city seemed to have faded a notch, like when a play is over and the lights go out after the last act. He got up from the bench and slowly made his way down the stairs. He left Shinjuku Station, went into a nearby restaurant, sat at the counter, and ordered meatloaf and a potato salad. He barely finished half of each. Not that the food tasted bad. This restaurant was famous for its delicious meatloaf. He just had no appetite. As always, he only finished half his beer. He rode the train home and took a shower and carefully scrubbed his whole body with soap. He then put on an olive-green bathrobe, a gift from a girlfriend back on his 30th birthday, and sat down on a chair on the balcony, letting the night breeze waft over him as he listened to the muffled din of the city. It was nearly 11 p.m., but he wasn't tired. Tsukuru remembered those days in college when all he had thought about was dying, already 16 years ago. Back then, he was convinced that if he merely focused on what was going on inside of him, his heart would finally stop of its own accord. That, if he intensely concentrated his feelings on one fixed point, like a lens focused on paper, bursting it into flames, his heart would suffer a fatal blow. More than anything, he hoped for this. But months passed, and contrary to his expectation, his heart didn't stop. The heart apparently doesn't stop that easily. From far off in the distance, he heard a helicopter. It seemed to be getting nearer, the sound growing louder. He looked up at the sky, trying to catch sight of it. It felt like a messenger bringing some vital news. But he never saw it. The sound of the propellers fading, then disappearing completely to the west, leaving behind only the soft, vague hum of the city at night. Maybe back then, Shiro had been hoping to break up their group. This possibility suddenly struck him. Seated on a chair on the balcony, he slowly filled out this hypothesis. Their group in high school had been so close, so very tight. They accepted each other as they were, understood each other, and each of them found a deep contentment and happiness in their relationship, their little group. But such bliss couldn't last forever. At some point, paradise would be lost. They would each mature at different rates, take different paths in life. As time passed, an unavoidable sense of unease would develop among them, a subtle fault line, no doubt turning into something less than subtle. Shiro's nerves might not have been able to stand the pressure of what had to come. The trauma of the inevitable end of this tight-knit group of friends. She may have felt she had to unravel the emotional bonds of the group herself or else be caught up fatally in its collapse, like a castaway sucked down into the abyss by the whirlpool of a sinking ship. Tsukuru could, to an extent, understand that feeling. Now he could, that is. The tension of suppressed sexual feelings began to take on greater significance than Tsukuru could imagine. The graphic sexual dreams he had later were probably an extension of that tension. And that tension must have had some effect. What exactly, he had no idea, on the other four as well. Shiro had wanted to escape from that situation. Maybe she couldn't stand that kind of relationship anymore. The close relationship that required constant maintenance of one's feelings. Shiro was unquestionably the most sensitive of the five, so she must have picked up on that friction before anyone else. But she was unable, at least on her own, to escape outside that circle. She didn't possess the strength, so she set Tsukuru up as the apostate. At that point, Tsukuru was the first member to step outside the circle, the weakest link in the community. To put it another way, he deserved to be punished. So when someone raped her, who did it and what the circumstances were behind her rape and subsequent pregnancy would remain eternal mysteries. In the midst of the hysteric confusion brought on by shock, she ripped away that weakest link, like yanking the emergency cord to stop a train. Viewed in this way, many things fell into place. Back then, Shiro followed her instincts and chose Tsukuru as a stepping stone, a way for her to reach outside the walls of their group. Shiro must have had a gut feeling that Tsukuru, even put in that awful position, would be able to survive, just as Eri, too, had arrived at the same conclusion. Tsukuru Tazaki, always cool and collected, always doing things at his own pace. Tsukuru got up from the chair on the balcony and went inside. He took a bottle of Cutty Sark from a shelf, poured some into a glass, then carried it back out to the porch. He sat down again, and for a time, pressed the fingers of his right hand against his temple. No, he thought, I'm not cool and collected, and I'm not always doing things at my own pace. It's just a question of balance. I'm just good at habitually shifting the weight I carry around from one side of the fulcrum to the other, distributing it. Maybe this strikes others as cool, but it isn't an easy operation. It takes more time than it seems, and even if I do find the right balance, that doesn't lessen the total weight one bit. And yet he was able to forgive Shiro, or Yuzu. She carried within her a deep wound, and had only been trying desperately to protect herself. She was a weak person, someone who lacked the hard, tough exterior with which to guard herself. It was all she could do to find a safe refuge when danger came, and she couldn't be particular about the methods. Who could blame her? But in the end, no matter how far she ran, she couldn't escape, for the dark shadow of violence followed her relentlessly. What Eri dubbed an evil spirit. And on a quiet, cold, and rainy May night, it knocked at her door and strangled her lovely, slim throat in a place and time that had most likely already been decided. Tsukuru went back inside, picked up the phone, and without thinking much about what he was doing, pushed the speed dial number for Sora. The phone rang three times before he thought better of it and hung up. It was already late, and he would be seeing her tomorrow. Then he would see her and talk to her in person. He shouldn't short-circuit the process before he saw her. He knew that. Still, he wanted to hear Sara's voice right now. The feeling welled up inside him so overwhelmingly that it was hard to suppress the urge. He placed the record of Lazar Berman's performance of Years of Pilgrimage on the turntable and lowered the needle. He turned his attention to the music. The scene of the lakeside at Hamenlina came to him. The white lace curtain rustling in the breeze, the sound of the little boat rocked by the waves, slapping against the pier. The birds in the forest patiently teaching their tiny bird babies how to chirp. The citrusy smell Aerie's shampoo had left on her hair. The dense weight of the life force, the will to survive, within the ample softness of her breasts. The hard phlegm spat out in the weeds by the dour old man who had shown him the way. the dog wagging its tail excitedly as it leaped into the back of the Renault. As he traced memories of these scenes, the pain in his chest that he had felt returned once more. Tsukuru drank the cutty sark, savoring the fragrance. His stomach grew faintly warm. From the summer of his sophomore year in college until the following winter, when every day brought thoughts of dying and nothing else, he'd had one glass of whiskey at night like this. Without it, he hadn't been able to sleep. The phone suddenly rang. He stood up from the sofa, gently raised the needle from the record, and stood in front of the phone. It had to be Sara. No one else would call him at this hour of night. She knew he had called and was calling him back. As the phone rang a dozen times, Tsukuru hesitated, unsure if he should answer. He bit his lip hard, held his breath, and stared intently at the phone like a person standing far away, off studying the details of a difficult formula on a blackboard, trying to puzzle it out. But he could find no clues. The phone stopped ringing, followed by silence, a deep, suggestive silence. To fill in the silence, Tsukuru lowered the needle onto the record again, went back to the sofa, and settled in to listen to the music. This time he tried his best not to think of anything in particular. With his eyes closed and his mind a blank, he focused solely on the music. Finally, as if lured in by the melody, images flashed behind his eyelids, one after the next, appearing then disappearing. A series of images without concrete form or meaning, rising up from the dark margins of consciousness, soundlessly crossing into the visible realm, only to be sucked back into the margins on the other side and vanish once again. Like the mysterious outline of microorganisms swimming across the circular field of vision of a microscope. 15 minutes later, the phone rang again, and again he did not answer it. This time he stayed seated, listening to the music, gazing at the black phone. He didn't count how many times it rang. Eventually it stopped, and all he could hear was the music.
Sara, he thought, I want to hear your voice. I want to hear it more than anything. But right now, I can't talk. Tomorrow, Sara may choose that other man, not me. Tsukuru thought as he lay down on the sofa and closed his eyes. It's entirely possible, and for her it may well be the right choice.
What kind of person this other man was, what sort of relationship they had, how long they had been seeing each other, all of this Tsukuru had no way of knowing. And he didn't want to know either. One thing he could say at this point was this. He had very little he could give her. Limited in amount and in kind, the contents negligible. Would anybody really want the little he had to give?
Sara said she has feelings for me.
He had no reason to doubt it. But there are countless things in the world for which affection is not enough. Life is long and sometimes cruel. Sometimes victims are needed. Someone has to take on that role. And human bodies are fragile, easily damaged. Cut them, and they bleed.
If Sara doesn't choose me tomorrow, he thought, I may really die. Die in reality, or die figuratively. There isn't much difference between the two. But this time, I definitely will take my last breath. Colorless Tsukuru Tozaki will lose any last hint of color and quietly exit the world. All will become a void. The only thing that remains a hard, frozen clump of dirt. It doesn't matter. The same thing has nearly happened a few times already. And it wouldn't be strange if it actually did this time. It's just a physical phenomenon, no more. The spring on a wound watch gets steadily looser. The torque grows closer and closer to zero, until the gears stop altogether,
and the hands come to rest at a set position. Silence descends. Isn't that all it is? He slipped into bed just before the date changed.